put down the rain. And trust that whatever you want to capture will be better captured if you really don't fragment your attention. Let's realize that in some sense, once again, we have arrived. And so we can take our seats, which is in some sense taking a stand, a signature gesture of aligning ourselves with the central axis of our body, and even more with the central axis of our hearts, and even more with the central axis, if you will, of our being. So allowing yourself to sit in a way that gives a sense of rootedness, whether you're on the chair or on the floor, that your feet are not, your legs are not crossed, but your feet are flat on the floor. And perhaps even sitting away from the back of the chair, sitting slightly forward on the chair, so that you're really self-supporting. And if you're sitting on the floor, it is best if you can take a cushion or something, a folded over pillow or blanket or whatever, and elevate your butt as much as you can above your knees. ordinarily, I wouldn't have this second cushion here, but my hip will no longer let my knee go down to the floor. And if I let it just hang there, the level of intensity of the sensation goes up very, very quickly. So I sort of learned to just keep it like that. However you accommodate the vagaries of your particular body and what it's been through over the course of your life, there's no magical importance to sitting meditation, but the sitting posture can be tremendously important. And being willing to sit on the ground or on the floor has its own element of groundedness that is different from the element of groundedness if you're on a chair, but not necessarily better. They, like all the other methods that are used, are really different doors into the same room. And the important thing is not to cling to the doorway and say how much you love this particular doorway, to walk in, to enter. So, and then it's important, you know, just to, if we start with posture, to do something with your hands that is mindful and that in some sense represents this gesture of wakefulness, even if you don't feel wakeful. And so one way to do that is to be conscious of how you position every aspect of the body. The hands are very important. So you could put them together in your lap and make a little kind of egg shape space, which is sometimes called the cosmic mudra. And the interesting thing about this one is, as your mind drifts away, the fingers drift apart, the thumbs drift apart. So I give you a little biofeedback here, you know, it's like to realize, of course you'll forget that your thumbs have drifted apart anyway. So. But at a certain point you might wake up and remember, oh yeah, I'm sitting like this. You can also fold the one over the other, which is another quite wonderful one. All these things have particular kinds of energies associated with them that you can play with. For instance, if you take your hands and place them on your knees for a moment, with the hands open towards the ceiling, that has a certain kind of energy associated with it, a kind of feeling to it. And what would you say it was? Open, receptivity. Now turn them down. maintaining awareness of the body. How does that feel in relationship to the openness and the receptivity?
Grounding.
Grounding.
What else? Contained.
Contained. Anything else?
All connected.
Excuse me?
Connected.
Connected.
Okay. Holding.
Holding. Yeah. So, and then what about the left one up and the right one down? How's that feel? Circuit of energy. Okay. When I sit like this, sometimes I feel like I'm holding Manjushri's sword. You know, because I'm right-handed, so holding the sword. Blade is laying in the open hand. And what is Manjushri's sword? Again, it's like the warrior pose in yoga. It's not about killing. It's about discernment. It's about cutting through ignorance. With the heart, with the mind, to the essential. So you don't even need to know that, you know, and that's just personal. I mean, I didn't read it in the book, it just feels that way to me. You could sit, I mean, you could do sit like this. You could go to the British Museum and check out the Buddhas and try each one of them and just stand there facing the statue for 3 or 4 hours. And people may even put pound notes in your head, if there is such a thing as pound notes with your estimation. But all of these have a certain kind of energy, and what does that mean? It invites mindfulness. When you have your hand is like this, or like this, and you take the index and you put, what does this do? Don't know. Okay, so we experiment. Feel. And it's not like it's supposed to make anything happen. It's not about making anything happen. It's about experiencing the body. So let's adopt a posture that feels comfortable to you now, including whatever you want to do with the hands. There are many more ways to do this and many more ways to sit. Mark is sitting on a meditation stool, a bench. Probably a lot of other people are too, although I can't see that. So you don't have to sit cross-legged. You can sit in a kneeling posture on the floor, also very grounded. It's in Japanese, it's called sitting seisan. And there are many different things you can do with the legs, from the full lotus to the half lotus to the quarter lotus to what's called the Burmese posture, which is what I'm sitting in, which is one leg draped on the floor and then the other leg draped in front of it. And your knees may or may not go to the floor depending on how tight your adductor muscles are. And that you can work with. If you sit for a long period of time, you'll get more comfortable doing that. On the other hand, discomfort is part of the inevitable unfolding of stillness, because we are so unused to being still that, and you could blame it on the posture and continue to shift to find the best posture where you won't be uncomfortable, but you'll be uncomfortable sooner or later in every posture. So then the question is, well, should I stop meditating or what? And the answer is no. I mean, it's like just part of the landscape. Is discomfort, how about we put the welcome mat out for it and begin to investigate that? And of course, you see, that's like working with a weight, you know, you're sort of working with the resistance of the weight, with what you most don't want to feel, and in not wanting to feel it, and yet moving towards it, turning towards it, opening to it, you learn something that actually is completely generalizable. Because this particular discomfort in my left knee or my right butt or my left earlobe or whatever it is, what you learn by really being in relationship to that is basically true for any part of your body. So there's a kind of, I keep saying this is a laboratory science. This is an investigation. It involves continual learning. And continual growing from the learning. And none of this has to be in any sense represented by cognitions, at least prematurely. First 20 or 30 years, I would say, better to stay away from model building. And I'm joking. you know, of course you'll read books and see what other people say and try to find different ways of experiencing things. But basically, you are the authority of last resort. And I would say the authority of first resort as well. So, sitting in a posture now that embodies wakefulness and dignity, let's actually close our eyes for this. And I'm going to guide you through a meditation that utilizes a particular image. Now, often we don't use images in the SR, or we use them very, very cautiously, because the use of most images in behavioral interventions and so forth are very often oriented towards escaping from present moment reality and going to some fantastic beach someplace where everything is wonderful, or a mountaintop, or, you know, just someplace else, your little garden where you feel completely, you know. But we use imagery when we use it in the service of deep connection, realizing the deep connection with the present moment. Here, where you are, in the midst of the full catastrophe, and in some sense or other, we're always in the midst of the full catastrophe. And if it's not our turn at the moment, it's somebody else that we love or care for that's going through something. And so, you know, there's never a moment where compassion, you know, really needs to be in abeyance, including self-compassion. But if it's not really compassion, then you'll develop what's called wrongly compassion fatigue. But compassion does not fatigue, because the compassion is boundless. Just the way awareness is boundless. Go looking for the boundary of your own awareness. Doubt if you'll find it. Go looking for the central point of your own awareness. Doubt if you'll find it. But the important thing is in the looking, not in, you know, taking anything I say over these 2 days at face value. I hope you don't take anything I say at face value. My job here is to be a troublemaker and to really, you know, incite a certain kind of disbelief and doubt and that investigative fervor. If you want to know, look. Not in the book, in the heart, and in relationality, which is another way of saying in the heart. So, as we close our eyes, let's begin by just getting a sense of the body as a whole sitting, just as we did yesterday. And breathing. Of course, it's breathing. We're being breathed, you might say. And I played with this one in the talk on Wednesday night. But frankly, if it was, you know, we often talk about like, what, my breath and I'm breathing. But frankly, if it was up to you to breathe, you would have died a long time ago. Because you would have gotten distracted. Whoops, forgot that. So in some sense, it's more appropriate to recognize that, hey, the natural wisdom of the brain and brainstem doesn't let us anywhere near the controls for the breathing or the heart. We could pretend that we can hold our breath, but you can't commit suicide by holding your breath. At a certain point, say, forget about this person, let's just breathe. It doesn't matter what she wants. Or, you know. But it's very, very labile in relationship to emotional reactivity. See how you're doing, just watch your breath, because it can, you know, sort of take so many different forms depending on whether we're frightened or whether we're, you know, angry, whatever, peaceful. So just riding on the waves of the breath. At the belly, at the nostrils, anywhere in the body that the breath sensations are most vivid to you. Feeling the body as a whole, as best you can. sitting here. Can you feel the outline of the body and the envelope of the body and the air around the body? Again, effortlessly, without trying, just noting, just attending to whatever the sensations are as you intend to take a look, to investigate and see whether there's anything here in the skin, in the form that the body's taking. And allowing yourself to step into your seat. As I said, to take a stand in your life, sitting, where all your energies integrate and come together in the very posture of sitting. That I would like to introduce to you and invite you to play with, experiment with, is the image of a mountain. So there are many ways to approach this. One is to, in your mind's eye, visualize, bring to mind a mountain, a favorite mountain in outline, or from a distance, or from whatever perspective you care to. Or to just make one up in your mind. And noticing the outline, the contours of the mountain. And then seeing if you can become coextensive with that mountain so that your body actually becomes the mountain sitting. Modify my words because inevitably we'll all have different mountains, but noticing that whatever mountain you have, that it has this element of massiveness and an unmoving quality to it, that it really is anchored in the crust of the earth. And so sensing in your own body that sense of rootedness, of just massive connectedness to the ground, the unmoving aspect of your own presence, your own body. And then appreciating the sides of the mountain, however they present themselves to you as the sides of the body, and then the lofty peak or high plateau or whatever it is, so that the head is actually elevated above the entire landscape that the mountain overlooks, whatever it is, and the sides of the mountain descend from the head to the base, and maybe and the shoulders, maybe shoulders in the outline and contours of your mountain. So becoming the mountain. Now what we can can say, one thing we can certainly say about mountains is they are pretty still. They just sit. They just sit here. Every time you take a peek at them, there they are in the same place. So sitting in this way, kind of unmoving, yes, of course, the breath is moving in the body, and we are not really just mountains. But we're exploring the just mountain aspect of ourselves right in this moment. Those elements, those features that we have in common. And of course, if you want, and you may be already a volcano, extinct or active. So mountains actually do breathe. Sometimes, just like us. So as we sit here, as the mountain, noticing that on a clear day, the panorama is vast in all directions. From the lofty peak extends for us, behind us, every side in every quadrant, in every degree of the horizon. And as we sit here, the sun moves across the sky. And the light and the shadows and the color, virtually are changing on the sides of the mountain, everywhere on the mountain, and everywhere in the landscape, moment by moment. And through it all, the mountain just sits, being itself. Day ends and night follows day through a fading of the light and arrival of dusk, and then day follows night, and night follows day, and through it all, the mountain just sits unmoving, just being itself. Of course, it's not always sunny during the day. Could be cloudy, stormy, foggy. The mountain never says, not happy with the view today. Too bad I can't see so far. This low-hanging cloud is really annoying. It just sits. Allowing everything to be as it is, completely at one with the vastness of the sky, the vastness of the mountain, and the vastness of the sky, one seamless vastness. The moon may come, the stars may come. We start in the fall. The mountain may be covered with all sorts of colors below the tree line, and filled with the songs of birds and the movement of birds in the air flying somewhere up towards warmth. There may be weeks and weeks of clouds and fog and rain through it all. The mountain just sits, not preferring, not needing it to be some other way. Cold intensifies, soon it's winter, maybe snow and ice, and freezing rain, storms of ferocious magnitude. Day and night, and through it all, through the entire season of the winter, the mountain just sits. Gradually, the sun climbs higher into the sky. Snows begin to melt. The streams begin to grow in speed and volume. New life begins to emerge on the slopes. And through it all, the mountain just sits. Soon the high meadows are filled with flowers, trees budding, birds returning, perhaps days of blue sky and fluffy white clouds, giving way to summer. Visitors, children, animals, all enjoying the beauty of the mountain, day and night, in every season, really. And through it all, the mountain just sits, being itself. You may notice as you sit here that even if we don't sit for an entire year without moving, that there are seasons in even a short sitting. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end. There are also weather patterns in the body and in the mind, changes similar to the changes of the seasons and the changes of the weather in the body and in the mind, some more long-term, some more fleeting. Certainly there are periods of calm when everything just feels warm, sunny, and much like a meadow flower. And then it can turn cloudy, tempestuous, stormy, icy, dark, cold. And you may find it really valuable, I certainly do, to not take these changes personally when they really aren't personal, but to just see them in some sense as weather patterns, as storms in the mind. And being the mountain is simply this knowing mountain that we are, and simply allow it all to unfold and hold it in awareness in a way that really has the same quality of equanimity that we impute to the mountain, that elemental steadfastness that we can bring intentionally into our posture and into our practice, even for brief periods of time. Not to fortify ourselves against feeling, or to ignore what we are feeling, but exactly the opposite. To allow ourselves to be covered in snow and freezing rain and darkness and light and warmth, recognizing that that is the nature of things. It is in the nature of things that they are always changing. And if we find some way to not take it personally, not only do we not compound the level of suffering enormously, but it's possible to actually recognize that there may be no intrinsic suffering in here to begin with. That a lot of its patterns, unexamined patterns, like depressive rumination, to take one example, or how we speak to ourselves silently about pain and discomfort, and what's happened to our bodies over the course of our lives, or what's happened to our hearts over the course of our lives. And this embrace of stillness and equanimity actually reflects the vast spaciousness of the heart and the mind and the body. And so when we take our seat in this way, in this mountain-like way, perhaps it can remind us and rebody us, but remind us of that intrinsic wholeness and spaciousness. It allows what comes to come, what lingers to linger, and what goes to go, noticing that there are no exceptions, that everything comes, lingers, and sooner or later goes. And the real question is, how are we going to be in wise and self-compassionate relationship with it? And perhaps part of the challenge of that question can can be met by taking our seats in this way from time to time. And allowing it all to rise up and rain down and blanket us. All the while resting in the invariant true nature of our mountain-like beauty. The beauty of our being. If you were here from the talk on Wednesday night, the enormous imbalance between what is quote-unquote right with us compared to what is quote-unquote wrong with us. Much of it, of course, a self-preoccupied narrative that is, at best, utterly inaccurate, at worst, terribly harmful, and closing off of options. And so, sitting. If the mountain image is helpful to you, then by all means bringing it right into your body with this breath. If it's not, then by all means just let it blow away with the next out-breath, if you haven't already. To be recruited at any time that it makes sense to you and otherwise. And so to find creative ways to support your practice, whether it's mountain meditation, or lake meditation, or tree meditation, or fire meditation, or an air meditation. These are all basically just kindergarten reminders. And I'm not devaluing kindergarten. Just reminders of our own beauty. And what the intrinsic luminosity of awareness. Gives us, I'm not sure it's infinite, but many, many degrees of freedom. Immediately delivers many, many degrees of freedom if we can bring awareness to those moments that are most terrifying, most painful, most trying, and most satisfying, and delighting, and joyful. Both in stillness, when it's a time for stillness, and in movement, when it's a time for movement. Knowing that stillness is folded into movement, moving, and moving is folded into stillness. At every level in this fractal world, and every level of this fractal heart. nothing but relationality, inwardly and outwardly, or even inner and outer, are merely convenient, inaccurate, but convenient ways of keeping things straight in a conventional way. And underneath, a seamless whole, completely coextensive with awareness. And inside this, healing and transformation. And everything that I've said is now in some way far more supported by science than it was even 5 years ago, or 10 years ago, or 15 years ago. But no amount of science and of conceptual discourse will be a substitute for one's first person engagement because it's only here that the healing actually unfolds. It's only here that the living of our moments actually unfolds. It's only here that we can make any choices that actually matter, because the motivation and the intention for them is in some sense wholesome, lawful, accurate, and adequate to the human condition in all its intrinsic wonder and beauty. And that means you. So in the remaining moments of the sitting, letting go of everything, all objects of attention, and just be the attending. In a stillness that knows no effort. In silence that knows no disturbance. Objectless, open presence, or presencing, a choiceless awareness. Completely coextensive with the body. field of mountain peaks in all directions. I must say that whenever I do a two-day workshop, I regret that it's not 10 days. You can feel that we're, I wouldn't even say scratching the surface, grazing the surface of possible here. And I want to be sensitive to finding the right balance between sort of just stillness, which is very, very important, and conversation, which is all equally important, and also questions and dialogue. And of course, with 250 people with a million different interests and concerns, that's the challenging order and really important. So I'd like to have this particular period now, if it feels okay to you, be a time where we can speak together about well, for one, the homework that I gave you overnight, if you remember it. Do you remember that? Did you do it? Anybody do it? Many times. And also just at this point, since we're looking at 4:30 to close this out, at this point, what you most need. Now, there's no way we're going to satisfy what everybody most needs. No way. If it were 10 days, we wouldn't satisfy it. If it were 100 days, we wouldn't satisfy it. It's unsatisfiable. Which is, again, one of the reasons to engage in mindfulness practice and to see how much we want to have it all understood so that we can operate it on it, operate on it, and with it in particular ways, specific ways, unique ways, ways that, you know, like if you're working with people with chronic pain or you yourself have chronic pain, how does this get applied to, you know, dealing with chronic pain? I try to embed some things about that in the guided meditation. And those of you who know something about MBSR, and I won't speak for MBCT, but MBSR, I don't make any apologies for this, but for myself, we guide the meditations, especially in the early weeks, a lot. So in the body scan, there's some reason for that, because obviously you need to sort of go through the parts of the body. It takes a long time just to name them. If you just had the list of them, never mind to inhabit them. So, you know, it's almost like, where's the silence in the body scan? It's everywhere. It's underneath the voice of the person who's guiding the body scan. If it's not, then it's just a litany of body parts. But so the silence is embedded in it, even though there's only a stretch of, say, a few minutes of silence at the end of my body scan, because otherwise we'd never get to the top of the head. As it is, people are saying, hey, come on, why are you taking so much time? You know, I didn't get the idea, you just zip up there. And yes, you can. And it's in fact highly recommended to do body scans of like one breath in, one breath out. Great. But there's a method in the madness of having them be 45 minutes or 30 minutes, and it really has to do with having it be long enough. And people ask me this question all the time, why did you make the body scan 45 minutes? And I said, well, because I wanted it to be long enough so that it wouldn't feel good anymore. So that you wouldn't get the idea, people wouldn't get the idea, oh, I guess it's less. It's a 10-minute nap, you know, or like, you know, a complete rejuvenation. He said, no, I want the discomfort to come up. I want the impatience to come up. That's one of the reasons it's slow. You know, come on, get on with it. We get the idea. And it's not about that. It's about being with where we are in the body. And it doesn't matter when we get to the head. It's like little kids in the back of the car. Are we there yet, Mommy? You know, are we there yet? There's no there. There's no there to get to. There's only here. So with your Manjushri sword, a lot of the time, if you notice that you, in your teaching, for instance, those of you who are in your therapy, if you wind up using, hearing yourself, give voice to something like, when you're there, you'll know it. Just take your Manjushri sword and chop off the tape. Because it's actually making, you're introducing a gaining idea that, oh, this meditation stuff is going to deliver something for you. If you do that on day one, you might as well close up shop forever. Because you've already created a separation between your actual lived experience in the present moment and some better place where you're going to get it. Somewhere. Meanwhile, we say, be as judge or non-judgmental as possible. Well, come on. I mean, we're already judging that we need to be somewhere else. If you need to be somewhere else, don't call it mindfulness. Even if it's hell at this moment, then we need to sort of welcome the devil in and investigate, what is this devil? Do you know what I'm saying? So I want to emphasize that this is not, I've said this before and I hope I don't offend people, especially since this is sponsored by the Oxford Cognitive Therapy Center. But this is not another cognitive behavioral technique that I'm teaching. It just isn't. It can't be understood in that framework, with those lenses. It's based on kind of the transformative potential of our humanity, woven into our DNA. And so this business of needing some things to be different, in some sense becomes an impediment, sometimes a major obstacle, actually recognizing and allowing things to be as they are and then inhabiting it in a way that actually, sometimes I put it this way. How many of you want the future to be different? Raise your hands. Be honest and just raise your hands if you want the future to be different. Yes, we want the future to be different. And how many of you spend a good deal of time planning for the future to work out exactly the way you want it to work out? Raise your hand, including grant writing. Okay. All right. And I'm not knocking that. That's part of that conventional world where we have to play by certain rules and we have a certain kind of discourse in common that actually could be tremendously imprisoning for anything resembling imagination, creativity, insight, and growth. Never mind healing and transformation. So think of that for a moment. And I've been dropping hints along the way, much like Hansel and Gretel, that I drop the pebbles, you know, as they go deeper and deeper into the woods. I've been dropping pebbles every once in a while. Let's say, in one moment, with things exactly as they are, good, bad, or ugly, the full ugliness at times of the human condition, the full challenge of it, you simply be with it as it is. You're here, not getting to any there. You drop the there, and you're willing to be here. For one moment. Let's call it mindfulness. One moment of mindfulness. How is that going to influence the next moment? Compared to, you are not mindful in this moment, and you're like in your head imagining some better outcome. Do you understand what I'm asking? Okay. How will that influence the next moment? To me, because I'm setting this up rhetorically because there's so many people we can't like have a big conversation about it except inwardly. But to me, if I sort of answer my own question, if I'm willing to be present in this moment, already the potential for the next moment is completely transformed by my willingness to be in this one. Do you know what I'm saying? If I develop a certain quality of non-distraction, I'll I'll repeat that, because you may have gotten distracted in that moment. If somehow a quality of stability of mind and non-distractedness, even, you know, not that stable, but stable enough so that it carries me from one moment to the next moment of now, then the next moment is going to be very different from the, as if I'm just out of touch and it's just happening to me, do you know what I'm saying? And I'm objecting every step of the way. I'm wondering when we're going to get there, some other there, especially if I have some powerful techniques in my back pocket that I've been trying to pull out and make happen to get me out of this situation. Can you feel how those might actually influence the future in different ways? The future being the next moment. Can you feel that? Or have I lost you, or am I just like wrong? Can you feel that if you take responsibility for this moment, the next moment has a potential that it does not have if you don't take that responsibility in the way that we're talking about? So, to me, that's, as far as I know, my only limited experience, the only real way to change the future is to own the present. And if you string those moments together, your future is going to be very different, because think about it for a moment. We are now in the future that we conceived of like 25 years ago when we were, or I don't know how young some people are in the room, but you know, that we conceived of some time ago. Like when I grow up, do you remember that? Did you ever have that thought? When I grow up, I'm going to be, and then you fill in the blanks. And I'm going to marry, if that's your inclination, and you fill in the blanks, you know, the princess or the prince, whoever. You hear what I'm saying? Okay. So I got news for you folks. You're planning and scheming and what courses you take in the university and what university you'll go to and how great that imprimatur will be and what this wonderful person you're going to find and live with and babies that are going to be so beautiful. And it's like how it's going to turn out while you're still like, you know, young and thinking about how your life is going to turn out. Well, I've got news for you, and this is independent of how young or old you may think you are. This is it. It's already turned out. This is it. Today. Here. Now. Have a problem with it? It's fine if you have a problem with it. But what are you going to do about it? What can you do about it? What we usually do is think, well, if then this changes or that changes, or I get rid of this car, or I buy that watch, or I get divorced, or I get married, or I get retired, or I get money, or I, you know, whatever it is, or I go to some other country. If I go to the United States. A lot of people from here did that at one point. It will all be magically fantastic. Did you see that that's kind of like some, to some degree, it's kind of a hypnotic trance that we induce in ourselves and then actually prevents us from being alive in the only moment that we are actually alive, in the only moment we could look, in the only moment we could see, in the only moment we could reach out, that we could touch, that we could feel, that we could express emotion, perhaps love, perhaps appreciate connectedness, nature, the sky, the earth, beauty. It's only here, but we persist in this kind of dream that it's all going to be better on Saturday night or, you know, when I grow up or whatever. So in terms of bringing this work into medicine or into psychology, no matter how compelling the brain scan evidence is, no matter how big the hippocampus gets, or how thick it gets, or how small the amygdala gets, or how thin it gets, or how great the insula turns out to be, or how much the results show that this actually has some potential for healing and transformation, as in the psoriasis study that we did a number of years ago and then replicated, that showed that people meditating, their skin clears four times as fast as people who are not meditating. You know, and that psoriasis is an uncontrolled cell proliferation in the epidermis, so it has, you know, genetic aspects to it that are very similar to basal cell carcinoma, which is like skin cancer. And if the mind can influence psoriasis, maybe it can influence skin cancer. Maybe it can, who knows? I mean, we don't know what these questions are, but these are second order things compared to like the heart of the matter. And the heart of the matter is you. And if you're a teacher or you aspire to do this kind of work, then you are the vehicle for that aspiration to unfold and flower and flourish in another. And they're never coming. I don't think I've had one patient come to me and say, I really want to tune down my amygdala. I can't remember a single case. People come usually to say, I'm in enormous amount of pain. One way or another, it could be emotional pain, it could be physical pain. I mean, enormous amount of pain. Is there anything you can do? And I always say no. No, there's nothing I can do. But maybe there's something you can do. Maybe there's something you can do. That's the whole foundation for MBSR, was actually to catch people falling through the cracks of the healthcare system and challenge them to do something for themselves that no one on the planet can do for them. Not neurosurgeons, not general physician practitioners, not orthopedic surgeons. When we need an orthopedic surgeon, a psychiatrist or a meditation teacher will not do. I'm not going to my best meditation teacher friend to have my hip reworked. Do you know what I'm saying? But if you aspire to do this kind of work, then you are actually, your being is the vehicle of transmission, of connection. You can't depend on the Dalai Lama, Mother Teresa, your hero of the moment, whoever it is. It's up to you. I find that insanely beautiful. It's like, we're stuck with it. Who asked for this karmic assignment? I don't know, but somehow it happened. That may be the mystery of why you're even here for this 2 days. I don't know. Well, people have come from far away. I asked the other day, how many of you are here from like more than 50 miles? And like, you know, lots of people raised their hands. But I didn't realize that people here from Saudi Arabia, from, you know, Norway, from Portugal, and from Italy, and probably a whole bunch of other places. It's like, well, what the hell did you come for? I hope it wasn't just to see me. It's like, yes, I did. Actually, that was like, it's true. I just came to see you. I was like, well, I hope that was at the surface, you know. And I was like, well, I'm really, 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 really here. It's not like, well, how's his profile? You know, it's a little whatever, you know. I didn't think he'd limp, you know. All that yoga and the guy's limping and he's going to go do shiatsu or something. So this is just to say that we are scratching the surface here, and when it comes to specific questions and issues, we're not going to have time to really deal with any of it in depth. And my sense is that what's most important is for us to move in and out of conversation, and I'd like to move into it now so that we can sort of, you know, bring up questions, bring up concerns, try to address whatever it is, and then go right back into intensive practice, if you will, as intense as we can set it up for, you know, sort of a 2-day situation like this. I'd like to do another body scan. I don't think it's going to happen. I'd like to do three more hours of yoga. I don't actually think we're going to be able to, you know, do that much more. I mean, we'd like, that's just sort of an, but that's not what's most important. I think what's most important is whatever we're doing is the most important. And if you have objections to that, I want to hear them. And if you have like concerns or questions about what am I really talking about, because you actually I'm not making sense to you, that's the most important thing. want you to leave here at least having some kind of intuitive sense that, okay, this is not going to come out of the textbook. And then I'm not going to just impose this on the world. But I'm going to, in some sense, use myself as a vehicle for deep understanding, depending on what I love, okay? So if you love cognitive therapy, then what better vehicle to use than to inquire about that? 300 years from now, cognitive therapy, every other kind of therapy, and everything we know about science, people are laughing at it, like, you know, look at what they thought. That kind of perspective. Do you know what I'm saying? So everything's changing, including cognitive therapy, including mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, including mindfulness-based everything. It's continually changing. It's not one fixed thing that, oh, we got it, you know, we discovered the answer to life. And here, now we're going to impose it on you. But there are certain kind of invariants, there are certain kind of fundamentals, just the way, for instance, in evolution, you know, when we go like this, we don't think, whoa, yeah, my actin filaments are sliding over my myosin filaments and they're contracting in this beautiful way, and like I can do this without any awareness whatsoever, and it's like amazing, you know, just work my whole life, however long that is, you know, but actually, actin and myosin evolved a long, long time ago, long before there were human beings, long before there were mammals, and it was such a good solution in evolution that it decided, I don't need any other way of doing it. We'll just keep that going with the humans. It's called conservation of molecular architecture. Okay? So that when nature finds something that really works, it doesn't discard it and say, oh, that was nice, but I think I'll try again. No, it builds on that. And so in the same way as we're developing a psychology of heart, as we're developing a psychology of wisdom, as we're developing a medicine of compassion, as we're developing a medicine of deep understanding of the nature of healing, we will make use of molecular biology, of genetics, of epigenetics, of neuroscience, of everything, but it has to be in the service of wholeness. And that wholeness is already us. It's not like, well, now I got to go out and get whole on top of everything else. No! You are already whole. All that's required is to realize it, and then to make it real, which is the same thing, and then to find ways to live in accordance with it. Okay? Isn't that something I made up? I mean, you know, that phrase that just moved through my head, find ways to live in accordance with it. Well, you know, the Chinese have been living in accord with the Tao for like 5,000 years. Have you read the Tao Te Ching? Well, go back and read it, or read it for the first time. It's like, it's all there. Have you read Chuang Tzu recently? Do you even know who Chuang Tzu is? He's like, Lao Tzu might have been a fictitious character. Chuang Tzu was probably a real character, another Taoist, you know? Taoist is like, beyond name and form. Real Zen practice beyond name and form. Real Tibetan practice, you know, Mahamudra and Dzogchen, beyond name and form. What's beyond name and form mean? Not like there are no names and forms. I think I'll just sort of turn into a liquid and flow out of the floor. No, it's non-attachment to appearance. It's not being so tricked by appearance that we lose touch with the underlying reality. So, as I said in my talk on Wednesday night, I see my real job here as being to remind you of something you all already know, but don't probably get that much encouragement around or reinforcement for. And that is to be yourself and to trust it. And to, as far as possible, monitor it so that you don't identify too strongly with those toxic elements that we all carry as part of ourselves, and that we don't get too inflated with the seductive ones. But that we, in some sense, recognize and cultivate wisdom in ways that are articulable with no words, through presence. And then do the best we can in terms of the words, the medicine, the science, the psych, the therapy. We just do the best we can. And if we're living our way into that, no one could ask for more. And no patient is going to not feel it. Because what do we most want? We want to be seen, felt, heard, and a sense of connection, a sense of belonging. And we already are it ourselves, and the fact that we live at a short distance from that is really a tragedy. So, Mike, we have that. Mike has the mic. Mike has been doing a fabulous job here, and I think we should just give him a round of applause. First of all, he's here for every single moment. Don't you love that? I mean, somebody really takes care. I feel so much more secure up here. Usually what happens is the audio person comes, sees that everything's working, leaves. And then when everything's not working, they're like nowhere to be found. You have to get on your cell phone and so forth. Mike, thank you so much for this. So we have some mics around in the audience. And why don't we just see where this goes, okay? And I will try to keep it sort of fairly contained so that, you know, try to speak from what you care about most. And in a way that's not overly cerebral, and that's close to your experience, okay? And if it's something that you need from me, don't be shy about voicing it. I may not be able to give it to you because I don't know what it is or how to do it, or I may choose not to give it to you because we have limited time. But I would like to at least hear a sampling in the room of where we're at the moment. Because as the teacher, and I'll say this because many other of you are teachers, I'm not following a script that I decided on before I came to the UK. Well, this is what those people in the UK need. Do you hear what I'm saying? I'm not doing that. I'm trying to feel from you what is called for, and then offer that up in a way that is, you know, coherent and in touch with the sort of deeper level of unspoken inquiry that was the original reason for coming in the first place. So, please. Yeah, just go up to the microphone. Where is that handheld? Okay, so somebody can take it. And if you want to go to, yeah, come up here. If you like to stand on the stage and look at everybody. And tell us your name and where you're from, just for fun.
My name is Mirek. I'm from the Czech Republic.
Welcome. Did you come here just for this?
No, I live in the UK.
Oh, good, okay.
I would have come, I think. I was thinking what's close to my heart was something that I thought about already yesterday and today as well. And that's, it's about connection, and today you spoke about the preservation of what nature does, that we don't throw away what's been working. And I was asking myself, as you sit here, as I see you, because I sit really close, I was acknowledging in myself who sits behind you. Who is there that is making this possible as well for us? Generations of people sitting their bums off and passing some knowledge and experience, and we are reaping the benefit of it through you. And I was just kind of maybe wanting to mention that it's really important for me to acknowledge that this is not in isolation. This is really, due to the love of other people.
Thank you so much for expressing.
I'm aware that maybe not everybody here, maybe not even many people here are Buddhist, but I just, today you mentioned the sword of Manjushri. Today it felt like you spoke much closer to Buddhism than yesterday. That was just my impression. And so it gave me the courage to come here and mention the word Buddhism, because I thought it fits here today.
Thank you. Yeah, let me just respond to you by saying a lot of people think that I'm a Buddhist, and back in the day I thought so too. And then I decided that that self-identification was just another self-identification, and there was some juice associated with it for me at a particular time. I was quite young, and it had to do with name and form and attachment. And since the Buddhism that I was learning was all about non-attachment, I had to sort of admit to myself that it wasn't about being a Buddhist for me. What was really interesting was about being a Buddha, not a Buddhist. And so usually when I speak about Buddhism, I speak about it using the word Dharma, which is the teachings of the Buddha, but it also means the lawfulness of things, like the Tao, the way things are. And I appreciate your pointing out that, you know, what I'm offering, there is a long line of people behind me that you can't see that I got this from. But none of them talk like me. None of them teach like me. I don't even teach like me, because I don't teach the same way I taught yesterday, as you just observed, or 10 days ago, or 10 years ago. And yet I'm always teaching the same thing. Do I understand that? No. I don't. But I try to actually specify who the leading influences are in my life. And if you go back and read the foreword to the acknowledgments to Full Catastrophe Living, there's a whole series of people there who I consider to be like, I wouldn't be able to be here doing what I'm doing unless they did what they did and taught me in a certain way. And that includes my parents. And that includes my children. I mean, probably my greatest teachers. And of course, my wife, I would say she's my, I mean, it's hard to know after a while who your greatest teacher is, because they're all different aspects of one teaching. And I did say, I don't know if you were here for the talk on Wednesday. Oh, you would have loved the talk, because I said that the Buddha wasn't a Buddhist. So I was very explicit. when I really want to get provocative, I'll say, and Jesus wasn't a Christian either. You know, that, I said that on national television in the United States on a conservative television. I think it's always good to remind people of like the fundamentals. You know? But so Buddhism is a very interesting thing, and I don't make any attempt to sort of disguise the fact that mindfulness is the heart of Buddhist meditation. Those words come out of my mouth virtually every day of my life, because I feel like it's important for people to understand that. But then it brings up the whole question of like, yeah, what is Buddhism? And everybody's got some misconception of, let's just call it, everybody has a conception of Buddhism. And they're virtually all wrong, because Buddhism's not a concept. And it's even a word that was coined by Europeans when they went to Asia. So it's like the Buddhists don't even, until very recently, didn't even use the word Buddhism to describe themselves. They describe themselves as followers of the way, or something like that, or the community of people who, you know, love. So, thank you. Is there anything else you'd like to say at this moment or inquire about?
I guess just sharing openly the joy of how far, thanks to you as well, this we are. I mean, meditation in healthcare, meditation and the NICE guidelines for depression, this is unbelievable.
It is unbelievable.
It is reality. And it's real. It's reality. So thank you very much.
Yes, and really, Mark needs to be thanked for that one much more than I. And it's and John Teasdale and Zindel Siegel, and it's an example of how, like, one person does what one person does, and it's always limited. Even if it's boundless, it's also limited. But when you touch someone else, and I can't even say I touch someone else, because they were touched, and, you know, it's not me that was, they got touched in some way. And I'm using that in a good way. Of course, if you know the English language really well, you have to be careful with the word touch, because somebody who's a little touched, you know, in the head, you know, it's like not so. But touched in a way that ignited passion in them for something that results in the National Health Service mandating mindfulness in certain cases. I mean, the Buddha would be getting up and dancing a jig. It's like, whoa, how did that come about? So I appreciate your comment enormously. And of course, if this were a 10-year retreat that we were on, actually it is, it's an endless, boundless retreat that we're all on. It's called this planet, and it's called life. So, but we would have much more time to investigate the ins and outs and the vagaries and who is behind me and who is behind you and who is behind Mark and who is behind everybody. And these are things to just keep in, I won't say in mind, but keep in heart. Okay, because no one is an isolated monad, just like, yeah, it's like, you know, and no science operates that way. Everybody who makes a contribution to science, it comes out of everybody else's contributions. I think it was your own Sir Isaac Newton that said, if I have seen farther, it's only because I stood on the shoulders of giants. Did I get that wrong? Did he say that, or was it somebody else? I think he said that. So, anyway. And thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah. So anybody else? Where's the microphone? Yes.
Well, I just wanted to just share briefly some of my experience.
What's your name and where you're from?
Susan from Hampshire.
Okay.
Some of my experience in the mountain meditation, yes. Which was, I feel my heart is beating again now. It was, well, I was overwhelmed, very surprised by the emotion that came up. And within a few minutes, I was just streaming tears, and I was just very surprised about that, with the mountain. And it was, yeah, very revelatory of a lot of emotion, a deep sense of loss coming up. And I used to live opposite a mountain, so a lot of the loss of letting go of that place where I lived. But then a lot of pain in my heart, and then a sense of, I can't remember what you said now, but something, feeling, I think it was when you were talking about the elements, I felt suddenly a fire in my heart. And that's right, it was getting so intense that I got into something I recognized, my teaching mode, thinking, I must remember all these words, because I teach MBSR, so this is a pattern I get into, thinking, I must remember that one, then I can teach that one, I must remember, and think, oh, teaching, Mrs. Teacher, Mrs. Fix-It. And I thought, now come back to yourself. And I could feel this fire in my heart, and I felt it was like a crucible, transforming. I thought, this is so uncomfortable, I don't want to be here. And then you said something about deep connection, and suddenly the fire just became a deep lake, and it was, oof, it was wonderful, and the tears were coming, and it was very, very strong. So thank you so much for that. And I have a question that's very close to my heart that I've brought with me here. Is I love the teaching, I love the work, but there's something that I guess I'm a bit attached to that I would like it to be different, is with the follow-up groups, that I'm experimenting different ways of follow-up group, and it just doesn't seem to be working like I would like. I've taught a lot of courses now, and people don't seem to feel the need to come to a follow-up group. Very few. Some do, and there is a regular group, but not so many people. And I feel quite pain about that, and I don't know what to do.
Do you talk with them on the phone? The ones that don't come?
Oh, no.
You invite them to come, they don't come.
Yeah, I send out an email. To
okay, and then you don't follow up.
No.
But you want them to follow up. Well, I'd be interested in knowing why they weren't coming. First of all, maybe you're being so successful they don't feel like they need to come because they've got their own practice and they're doing it and they got in 8 weeks enough for 8 years, say. I mean, that's my intention. When I'm teaching for 8 weeks, I don't actually want people to come back. I want them to get it in those 8 weeks, and I'm using a kind of get it in quotes, but I want them to be so nurtured that they've got, you know, squirreled away stores in their, you know, DNA for the next lifetime. And then if they want to come back or fine-tune, recharge their batteries or fine-tune their understanding, well, there are an infinite number, and nowadays especially, there are teachers everywhere, there are books everywhere, there are guided meditation CDs everywhere from lots of different teachers and lots of different traditions. So the wealth of stuff that's out there, you realize, like, in the 60s, there was nothing. You had to go to some specialized bookstore where they sold, you know, marijuana paraphernalia. And in the back room, they had some crusty old books that were printed in India or China. And, like, you know, that was it. And most of them weren't in English. So now is like such a cornucopia of availability that maybe you're being so successful, and I don't know whether this is true or not, that you've actually launched people on something and they don't need to come back. Maybe there are other kinds of barriers. One is that people are unbelievably busy. I don't know if you've noticed that. Just unbelievably busy. For people to find time just to get their butt on a cushion for 10 minutes a day would be extraordinary. For them to come to MBSR for 8 weeks and do 45 minutes a day, at least, it winds up being more like an hour and more, as you know. That is also extraordinary. So the fact that you're getting people who are going through 8 weeks, well, you need to bow to yourself for that one. And is that going okay? Is that going well? And you're happy with that? Okay, so then if you want to really have high attendance at follow-up classes, meditate on what would bring you high attendance in follow-up classes. When I was teaching follow-up classes at MBSR at the hospital, you know, I would think of themes that I wanted to explore myself, and then I'd just do it. And if one person showed up, that was better than none. And, you know, I'd do it for one person. And if 50 or 100 people showed up, so much the better. You know, and, you know, I can remember lots of different things, and other of my colleagues have done other things. I mean, musicians do music and mindfulness, and, you know, you can do relationships with mindfulness. You could try sex and mindfulness. You'll probably get a better turnout. Or if you don't want to go that far, relationships, you disguise it. You know? Try eating and mindfulness. You know, I mean, so sometimes it requires a kind of, I wouldn't say marketing, but a kind of deep thinking about where people are starving for authenticity. And then you provide at the interface with your own authenticity and see what happens. Does that make any sense to you?
That's a wonderful answer. Thank you very much.
Just pass the microphone to somebody else. There's a microphone. There are microphones here for people who want to.
Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you so much for this amazing workshop on my heart, and I feel privileged to be here.
Could you say your name and where you're from?
I am Alicia, and I'm from Venezuela, but I have been living in the UK for 25 years. One thing I have noticed with practice mindfulness is that I feel more alive and more like a child, like looking life again, or feeling life with new eyes. And you said something that your children are having also your teachers, so we have a lot to learn from children.
Yes.
And sometimes I ask myself, are children mindfully, naturally, because they are sort of masters in being in the present moment? But are they just masters in being in the present moment and not mindful because they don't have the awareness and the intention? Or do they have choiceless awareness? Or what? What do you think?
So you just gave it away in your last sentence. What do I think? Well, you don't want to know what I think. It's much too precious a question for that. So, yeah, I have ideas or opinions about it, but really, let's just stay with the observing of it, that there's something luminous, beautiful, completely present about children, especially when they are happy or when they are, you know, loved and not harmed and haven't had a history of their love being unreliable and sprinkled with harm, which is much more common than any of us want to believe. So, and they are us, okay? We were all children.
Yeah.
So,
and we become children sometimes again.
Yes, yes, not in the same way though.
Yeah.
So the question is, can you remain in some sense or touch that aspect of you that is childlike rather than childish? Because we all like can be more than childish at times, you know, and have temper tantrums and, you know, sort of fits of one kind or another.
No, I don't mean in that sense. I mean regaining that freshness.
Well, yeah. Well, why regain it? Why? What makes you think you lost it?
Well, I feel that I have lost it and I have regained it with mindfulness.
Okay. But was it lost or just misplaced?
I don't know. Perhaps.
I'm trying to provoke you into sort of a kind of inquiry. That you say you lost it, okay? But maybe it didn't lose you. Maybe it never let go of you. Maybe it's been here all the time. And then mindfulness is like, you know, all of a sudden the veil is removed and you realize that some of those elements of your being that were there in childhood are still here now. And so to that degree, you are that same magical being, only now in a more adult form and constantly changing. So, yeah, is there a lot to be learned from children just by being in wise relation? I consider them, and my wife and I wrote a book on mindful parenting, and in it I say very clearly that I always considered my children to be like little live-in Zen masters, you know, sort of parachuted into our family to push every single one of my buttons where I was holding on to any kind of fixed concept about anything, like you cook dinner and then you eat it. Uh-huh. Anything like that. And you'd be surprised, once you have a little child in the house, everything is up for grabs. There's not one thing that you're not attached to that you're going to not have to actually really examine and be confronted with. Like, you know, is it the child or is it my attachment to having things be a certain way that's important? And if you're not careful, your attachment to having things be a certain way could be much more important than your child. And that is one of the deepest tragedies of our time, and probably of all time. There's never been an era where children have not been abused and disregarded and neglected. And often they weren't even considered human in the old days. So this is a very, very deep subject, and I would say that the most important thing is not what I think about, like why they're, whether they're really aware or whether they're in some other stage of development. I think what's most important is that you've touched something in yourself, that you associate with that kind of elemental purity and openness in beginner's mind, Because everything's fresh and new as a child, and we have not that many concepts that form the lenses through which we see everything. And so we have an opportunity in every moment that we have, before we're no longer here, to actually realize or reconnect with what I like to call what is the distant best in ourselves. Our own genius, so to speak. That genius that we see in children, and you say, my God, you know, in the first year of life, I mean, they go through more change than, you know, ever again. I mean, because the brain is formulating itself, and you see, like, language, and everything is like, everything is a miracle. That's as true for you now as it was for you when you were 1 year old.
Yes.
But we get, like, locked into certain kind of thought patterns,
yes,
and behavioral patterns. So as soon as you unlock the door, it may be the door wasn't even locked, it was just closed and you thought it was locked. You know, prison doors wide open, but we stay in the cell. You know, maybe it's time to come out. And so that, if you're a therapist, that's what we're inviting our patients to do. It's not like, oh, get to become a different person. Become the you you always wanted to be. No, how about become the you you always have been, but have kind of somehow misplaced or lost in touch with. So that's basically what I, you know, I don't know if that's an adequate response to
yes,
your
Yes, it is, and I think it was misplaced. Thank you. It wasn't
Thank
lost. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And to just say, I think there was one stream of thought that I kind of didn't complete a while ago, and that's to say, I went into the body scan, why I talk so much in the body scan, but actually, I do a lot of guidance in virtually all the meditations at the beginning, because, and I don't apologize for it, because I'm trying to lead people into themselves in a particular way, in a kind of feeling, felt, grounded experience of the present moment, so that they can then abandon the CDs, abandon the guidance, but have some kind of familiarity with silence and stillness without any input, and like know how to be, at least at the beginning, in relationship to silence and to stillness and to not having anything happen. And I believe that in the early stages of meditation, those of you who are meditation teachers in MBSR and EC2N, the responsibilities that we carry are enormous to not confuse people at the beginning. Because I have met people who've been practicing in Buddhist Zen centers and different kind of communities with fantastic teachers for 30 or 40 years, and they are terminally confused. Terminally confused. Not that the teachers meant to confuse them, but sometimes, like with the cross-cultural stuff and everything, you hear one thing, it's not actually what was said, you believe it, and people aren't checking on your understanding, and 30 years go by, and you have no idea how to be in wise relationship to the present moment unfolding. And I feel like it's our responsibility to really carry people along to the point where they just, like training wheels on a bicycle, where they, like, they get it, you know, they don't even have to know it. No one knows, like, you know, sit down, read the manual, how to ride a bicycle, just get on the bicycle, one day you go. And it's the same with the meditation. It's like the instructions are just kind of like scaffolding. They're not the real bicycle riding. So when you're riding a bicycle, you're not telling yourself, push with this, push with that, but be careful not to go too far over. It's body. And so our responsibilities for teaching the meditation really require us to think very deeply and also intuit in a very, very deep way how many different ways we can get people to go off on the wrong foot. Okay? And the most common one is to think, well, there are a lot. One is that meditation is about making your mind blank. But that's a subset of, like, the bigger thing of, like, there's some special meditative state, and if I just get there, then everything will be fantastic. Just like the one meditative state. There is no meditative state. Every state of mind is a meditative state if you bring awareness to it, including anger, including rage, including despair, including moments of complete humiliation. If you embrace them with awareness, inconceivable and that will never happen through thought. But we can have a lot of thoughts about it once we have the experience, but we need to have the experience. So that's just to say why in a workshop like this, even though many of you maybe have been have meditation practices for 40 or 50 years, I do so much talking. Because, and I don't differentiate from guiding a meditation and what we're doing right now. I mean, this is talk meditation. It's talk yoga. That our conversation is as much a part of the practice as sitting. And if I, let's say, for the mountain practice, I didn't open my mouth for those entire, what turned out to be 40 minutes, 45 minutes. And it just sat. Well, that would, you could say, one friend, well, that would be the highest meditation, just like no talk at all. Well, that depends on what's going on inside your mind. I mean, it could be like, you know, hours of self-distraction. Moments here and there of, oh yeah, I'm supposed to feel my breath, or something like that. So I take this responsibility very seriously, and it's not about talk, and it's not about silence, it's about how one is woven into the other for the sake of wisdom, and for the sake of clarity, and for the sake of kindness. And I don't know how else to say it, I mean, you know, it's just coming out of me, but the reason I'm saying it is because if it's going into you in one way or another, then it's invitational. It's to kind of not copy me or write down what I say, but to copy you. You get my meaning? And that's how this will stay alive. Anything else will kill it. Operationalizing it, manualizing it, you know, paint by the numbers, it will be dead in some time. It might still sort of be alive in some corner of the therapeutic world, but it won't be therapeutic anymore. And it certainly won't be healing or transformative. And I would consider that to be a missed opportunity of mega proportions, especially at this particular moment on our planet, where we need the full bore, you know, wisdom dimensions of this work. We need it in every way. And there's no one else out there to do this. I'm going to, from here to New Delhi, and I'm going to spend, you know, 3 or 4 days with the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama ain't going to do that. You're going to do that. The Dalai Lama can't do what you do. You can do what you do. He'd be the first one to tell you that, by the way, but of course, since he's the Dalai Lama, nobody would believe him. He says, I'm just a simple Buddhist monk, and everybody says, yeah, sure. He is and he isn't. And you are and you aren't. That's the beauty of this. I mean, when someone walks into our office, I invariably say, oh, to myself, not to the person, because they'll freak out. But I say, oh, another miraculous being has arrived. I'm not joking. Even if I know the person, I'll say that. And I've got ideas and opinions about the person. The person comes with a diagnosis. I never, ever look at the diagnosis when the new person comes. And of course, you know, of course I'm not a therapist either, so I don't have to do what anybody else does. But I don't want to know what someone else thinks this person is dealing with. I want to ask them, why are you? And then I want to listen 150% if I can manage that. Do you know what I'm saying? And then, of course, I'll read the medical record and I'll read the diagnosis. But first, I want to hear it from the person. And it never boils down to a diagnosis. Never, ever. It's a human being. A genius. Usually suffering. Hurting in one way or another. And the question is, can we meet in some way that would be beneficial? And I see, you know, I can tell you, having done this work now for, like, you know, in various forms for, you know, well, the stress reduction clinic's 32 years old, and I've been doing it long before that, that whatever they get from the practice. Nothing compared to what I get from them. I mean, they think I'm teaching them, but it's the other way around. They're teaching me, at least they're giving as much as they're getting. They may not realize that, but it's humbling. It's incredible. Sir.
Thank you. I'm John Capp. I'm the secretary of a mindfulness interest network in Brighton and Sussex, mainly having facilitators for the NBC tea course. Our difficulty is something that we have a lot of discussion about, and I would very much appreciate what you can say about it, is the issues of self-referral, doctor referral, and whether or not the facilitator should in any way vet the people or participants before they come.
Thank you. I'll answer this on a number of different levels. The first answer is, yes, it's important to vet the people who come. I'm not quite clear what the context is for you, but I'll talk about my context in the mainstream of medicine, and then you can interpolate it for whatever your context is. Okay, so in medicine, the way this started out, and it was a strategic decision on my part for lots of reasons, because my aim from the beginning was to move the bell-shaped curve of medicine itself, and actually that was a stand-in for the world, but we started with medicine in a mainstream medical hospital, medical school and medical center. So the doctors needed to be involved in it. And first of all, how many of you here are physicians? Raise your hands if you're a physician. So there are at least a number of physicians. One of the most stressful things of being a physician is to not know what to do with the people that you're not helping. And so to provide an environment that says, send us all the people you don't want to see or don't know what to do with anymore, is reducing the stress of the physicians in the hospital to an enormous degree. And I want to recognize that they are incredibly stressed, and medicine has squeezed the practice of medicine until it's almost unrecognizable, and virtually everybody I know who's practicing medicine in the hospital is depressed. And no longer feels that they're even in control of their own discipline, because it's business people who are making all the decisions and politicians about medicine and how it's practiced, which is an enormous shame, and it needs to be, in some sense, recovered, and it's in the process. So the idea was we would send out letters, it was before the internet, send out letters to physicians in various specialties and subspecialties, asking them to send us patients that, the shorthand, that they didn't know what to do with, but we gave a series of characteristics that they were suffering from stress, chronic pain, lifestyle-related issues associated with their diagnosis, and so forth. And that's how we got most of our referrals, okay? So it wasn't people walking in off the street or just sort of trying to recruit from the general public. Over time, of course, doctors would talk to each other, so we'd get more and more referrals, not only from the hospital, but from practicing docs in the community and so forth. And then, of course, people talk. So just to complete that, we're an intimate part of the medical record, because I wanted people to be reading about mindfulness in the medical record notes. So on every single referral, we would dictate a note after we saw the patient in an individual interview. And one of those was to determine the appropriateness of the referral. Because a lot of people, if they think, oh, now we're going to send you to get your stress reduced, and all you have to do is sit there and we'll do our magic wand thing on you and your life will magically change, that's not a great candidate for MBSR, which is one of the hardest things to do in the world. And we say that to people. This is just about the hardest thing you will ever do. And probably, you know, what else is worth doing then waking up to your life. So we would interview the patient, then dictate a medical record so that the doctor would do, oh, patient sent to the stress reduction clinic. You know, the patient is training in mindfulness. You know, the doctor, of course, has no idea what mindfulness is. This is 1979. But over time, it became the coin of the realm, I mean, part of the language. And then when the patient finished or dropped out, they would get a note saying, the patient dropped out, these were the reasons, or whatever. So we always followed up with people. And we knew why they were there. Or at least we'd met them enough so they were in. So this kind of vetting, I think, is extremely important. We've since changed our format, so we don't do those individual interviews because they've become far too expensive, and too expensive in terms of time as well. So we do them on a group basis, which is, in some ways, we're worried about, but they're turning out to be just as effective. And then we meet with people individually for a very short period of time. And we also flag anything on the forms that people fill out that indicate anything having to do with suicidality or any kind of sort of severe mental disturbance or history of hospitalizations, psychiatric hospitalizations. Remember, we started out with a mainstream medical population referred by orthopedic surgery and general medicine, and primary care, and anesthesiology in the pain clinic. And then it spread out to cardiology and surgery and, you know, so on. So I do think that it's very important to vet people. One, so that you know at least the bare bones of who you're dealing with, and you've negotiated with them what their responsibility is in this, because it's all about taking responsibility yourself. And if it's inappropriate, if people say, like, let's say someone's sent to the stress reduction clinic because their husband just died, that might not be the best moment, or they just got a breast cancer diagnosis. That is not the time to come to a stress reduction clinic. They need something else because they're in a kind of acute crisis mode. And what MBSR is really designed for is chronic crisis. Chronic problems, one kind or another. So we need to be responsible in that way. Also, we don't want people referred to us for, say, headaches, and it turns out they have a brain tumor. So they have to have the appropriate medical screenings. And we need to make sure of those kinds of things. So that's the virtue of that. On the other hand, if you're in a different kind of setting, you might have to structure it differently. But I think that the thought that goes into the question that you asked and how you might actually make those decisions in your group, given your intimacy with who you're working with and what your aim is, that whatever that process will wind up being, it will have a lot of integrity. If you ignore the whole question, that's dangerous because people are going to come that could potentially need something else or be triggered into, you know, some kind of something because we didn't realize that they had a history of trauma and then they wound up, you know, sort of having some kind of untoward experience. So you can't completely protect against that happening. But I do think it's our responsibility as health professionals of one kind or another, if that's the case for your group, to do that. If you're in a Buddhist retreat center or something like that, even they are beginning to realize that maybe not for coming to an evening talk or an evening meditation, but for a 10-day Vipassana retreat, for instance, or maybe not even a 10-day, but a 100-day Vipassana retreat, you need to know who you're bringing on board because, you know, a lot of those people may be so unstable in thinking this is their last resort, is Buddha's going to save them, and Buddha's not going to save them when they find out that it's like, hey, this is like the world's most boring activity. So then they can, you know, decompensate in ways they could be. I don't know if that answers your question. Do you have a follow-up to it? Or?
No, thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yes.
I'm Stephanie Howlett, and a colleague and I run a psychotherapy service in a neurology department for patients with psychogenic neurological symptoms. So it's things like non-epileptic seizures, unexplained paralysis, weakness, motor symptoms.
So is the word psychogenic just kind of default because you don't understand what it is?
No.
Or do you know what psychogenic means?
They're usually highly traumatized, a lot are quite dissociative.
Okay.
But they've come to see a neurologist for a medical solution, and then they're referred for psychotherapy. They're people often who are very fixated on the body but wanting a medical cure. And I can see that a gentle introduction of mindfulness into their lives would be really good. But I just wonder if you have any experience or guidance about that, because it could also be very triggering. And,
It's almost guaranteed to be very triggering, but I don't think that's an impediment. I think that just means, excuse me, that the mindfulness teacher or therapist has to know what he or she is getting into, okay? And be prepared for those moments when something comes up, okay? Even the little bit that we've done, you'll notice that every moment is a moment when something or other comes up, right? So. We're talking about sort of extremes here, and if you're talking about, as was mentioned yesterday, people have had extreme experiences of trauma. I'm not sure calling it psychogenic is, to me, not being a neurologist or even a physician, is helpful, but especially if we glump onto the diagnosis and miss the patient, the person. Another thing that I wound up not saying during my talk was one of the cardinal things that we do from the very beginning with people who arrive is that we say, if whatever it is that you have, from our perspective, it's workable, as long as you're willing to do a certain kind of work. So what's very important is to establish a framework from the beginning with ground rules of what this will be and what it's not going to be. Okay? So first thing it's not going to be. And maybe you noticed that coming up in some of your small groups yesterday in the circles. Anybody notice the impulse to rescue somebody else during the time? I mean, being all therapists. Did anybody get into kind of even a glimmer of like wanting to rescue somebody or make it better for somebody else? Maybe. Okay. Well, the first thing to not do is rescue the person. Okay? But to actually meet them. Meet them. With the kind of not knowing mind. Not knowing what's going to happen. But invitational in the sense that we invite them to actually work with these processes, work with these practices, work with these ways of being in an experimental mode and see what happens. And we're going to hold the whole thing in a context that really establishes safety and trust to the degree that we can do that. How? By being present ourselves. Not by saying, hi, you can trust me. I never trust anybody who says you can trust me. I mean, I run in the other direction. As soon as they go, trust me, I'm so sincere. I'm sincere. You say, are you kidding me? I'm out of here. But you know what I'm talking about. To establish an environment that is like recognizes the genius and the humanity and the enormity of what people are carrying, which is the Latin root meaning of the word to suffer, as I'm sure you know. So people are carrying a lot. And of course it will express in all sorts of ways, some of which will be like, you know, these neurological symptoms that don't have any explanation. So we say, well, it's in the mind, you know, but we don't, that doesn't help us at all. But how can we work with this? And the answer is, any way we can figure out how. You know, trusting in the practice, trusting in the Dharma, if you will, if you understand what that it means, to actually let the presencing and the relationship and the invitation to practice seeing, letting be, seeing, letting be, seeing, letting be, with whatever comes up, and see what happens. And then maybe taking the briefest of glimpses. You know, I'm not going there. Forget about it. And then I'll just stay with the breath, or I'll stay with the mountain, or I'll stay with that, but no weather patterns for me. I'm just going to be the mountain. No weather, no seasons, no nothing. I'll just be rigid. That's a great place to start. No problem. And then maybe a little softening will happen all by itself. You won't be doing anything. I don't feel like in the years that I've been doing this work, I actually do anything to people. People come up to me and say things like, you saved my life, or you helped me so much. And I'm not being kind of false. It's not false modesty. It's like, hey, let's recognize that I don't even know who you are. Only you could possibly know who you are. And so we have to sort of pray. I might have been instrumental in some kind of way, but let's recognize that you said yes. You put your ass, if you don't mind my putting it that way, on the cushion. You were willing, and that's a metaphor, that's not just sitting. You were willing to connect with yourself or trust a process. You were even willing to show up. A lot of times we don't actually give enough credit to the fact that the person's come. They're not a no-show today. They're voting with their feet. Enormous. You're 90% of the way there.
Yeah, one of the things that I've been doing this for nearly 8 years now, and one of the things that I've learned is that if people do experience seizures or dissociative episodes in the session, is that I don't try to stop it, that you can stay connected and mindful and interested. I'm now able to stay connected and interested and mindful and with what's happening and their experience.
Now, how does that unfold then? When you don't go into fear, or you may go into fear to a degree, but you don't let yourself completely disappear into fear. But instead, you stay present and trust in the unfolding.
Then I think I help the patient not go into fear, but I help the patient also to be interested in what's happening to them.
And then what happens?
And then we can develop a greater understanding of what this is about.
And does that happen? Do you see that happening?
Yes, yes.
Do you see it happening more times than not?
Many of the patients, I think, are quite closed, so it's hard work to get to that stage. But if we can have that connection, then...
When they do arrive at that moment?
Yes, then that can be very transformative.
Okay. And are you patient? In other words, are you trying to force them to get to a stage?
As patient as you can be when you have a limit of 20 sessions.
Yeah, I don't understand the British system, so I understand that there will be time constraints and pressures of one kind or another. But so that's a wonderful answer, as patient as you can be.
Yeah.
And is that part of the conversation with the people who come to see you, that they understand this context, that they've only got so much time before the sessions run out? Is that a motivator?
Yes. I always explain that at the start of the therapy, but I try to keep it in mind and remind people as we get through the therapy.
Right.
And that
because
can be
it's always,
later.
It sounds like you're just doing beautiful work.
Thank you.
Yeah, and it's always about keeping the present moment in mind. So what people need to be reminded of is skillful to remind them of that. And also to make a lot of space for them to simply experience what they're experiencing. And no good, no bad. Just what they're experiencing. And then you can, as I mentioned this at some point, do these people have sort of a high level of insight? Or are they severely compromised? I mean, can they be aware of their experience while they're having it?
There are often people who are fighting not to experience,
avoidance.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Very strong avoidance.
Yes.
But can they be aware of the very strong avoidance?
Yes.
Okay. So that awareness is the same awareness as awareness brought to, say, moments where they let go of the very strong avoidance, or they let go of the terror, or they let go of the pain, or they let go of the memory, which means let go means let it be present without having to do anything with it, including run from it or work with it. And that awareness, you can point out to people continually, is not suffering. It's part of that intrinsic genius that's already okay in them, and that gradually they might learn to trust and actually inhabit more, and be able to sort of, when the aversion arises, to actually recognize that it's aversion, and to feel it in the body, and to see the prodromal or early warning signs for it, and to notice about the dissociation, and to actually, hey, nothing could be, what do people do when people are dissociating? They remind them to ground themselves, right? To ground themselves in the room, to ground themselves on the floor, to ground themselves on the chair, to ground themselves in the body. So, like the mountain, ground, ground. Okay? So people who need to be grounded, 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 and you realize pretty soon you're reclaiming the base of the mountain, but there's this whole rest of the mountain. Well, gradually that grounding will actually lead you, because there can be an awareness of the ground, and there can be also an awareness of other than ground. So I'm just in awe of what you are doing. And just bow deeply to your forehead. And this is experimental. It's like you're finding that mindfulness brought to it in the way that you're bringing it to this situation can be of some value. I would urge you to, write about it. Let other people know what you're doing. I'm not just speaking to you, I'm talking to all of you. I mean, that's the way the world changes. Is you find yourself doing something that is in some sense remarkable, meaning you can make some kind of remarks about it, then to share it with other people, because your observations are important. If you can do it in a way that's more like, longitudinal study or something like that, so much better.
Thank you. I think what you said about focusing on the awareness of the avoidance rather than battling and overcoming, but an almost an acceptance and understanding and feeling of the avoidance. And that's something I take.
Yeah, away. And from a therapeutic point of view, this might be considered paradoxical, therapy. But it's actually, from a meditative point of view, it's not paradoxical. It's axiomatic. It's just like, hey, the awareness is here, but no one's noticing it. And it turns out that all the energy is in the awareness, all the wisdom is in the awareness. And if you bring awareness to experiential avoidance, you're no longer avoiding experience. How long did that take?
Thank you.
Please.
Hello there. My name's Silma. I'm from the Milton New Forest area. I'm not a therapist or physician. I have chronic pain, and I belong to an organisation that helps and supports people with chronic pain, and they also all have chronic pain. So mindfulness is sort of one of these box of tricks that we have to drag out to help with our chronic pain from time to time. I've been doing meditation for a number of years, probably about 20 years or so. So mindfulness was kind of second nature for me, I thought, although it is something quite different in the way that it's practiced, in as much as you're mindful of the moment. Whereas meditation that I've been used to, you touched upon it a couple of times, about sort of going somewhere else almost. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if I get further into sort of mindfulness and the teachings and such like, is there going to be any conflict with regards to what I think, because I haven't studied it, seems to be the Buddhist way of meditating in as much as being in the present, and other ways of meditating, which the going somewhere and having come back feeling that much better is all part and parcel of the package.
What a beautiful question. I'm not sure I know how to answer it, but let me give it a moment's reflection. I think at the early stages, it might be very confusing. When you're like yourself, like 20 years into it, there's a certain kind of maturation that I was mentioning yesterday that, you know, allows you to be more expansive in your experimenting and you're playing with things that at face value might seem completely contradictory. But if you start out at the very beginning trying to escape from where you are, it's like it doesn't work, you know? I mean, it might, I don't even like to use the verb work, you know, in association with meditation for obvious reasons, but but visualizations and the various kinds of things that do transport you someplace else are really, in some sense, not wise to introduce when you're trying to ground people in the present moment experience. And because fundamentally they're escapist. And while working with chronic pain conditions, for instance, people might feel really great escaping from their pain at certain times. There are other times that it's not going to be available to them to escape. And so we want to teach them something that will be available 24/7 under any circumstances, and that is not to turn away, but to turn towards. Now, who wants to turn towards the unpleasant? Who wants to turn towards pain? It turns out that when you do that, pain is not one monolithic thing, as you well know, and that there's a whole universe in there that you can actually enter, if you are crazy enough to do this, and discover that there's huge degrees of freedom inside those sensations. And we're very quick to label them pain, and that becomes a habit, and then we're living with a pain in our head that's really more thought-based than the actual somatic nociceptive element of it. And so there's a whole geometry and yoga of this that's incredibly important. And my biggest concern is not to confuse people. On the other hand, in all of the meditative traditions, there are all sorts of really confusing, elaborate, tantric meditative practices that could be tremendously valuable to any of us at particular moments or stages in our life. And if you have them in your bag of tricks, by all means, use them. Do you hear what I'm saying? So I don't have any kind of like injunction against anything like that. But my job, for the most part, is to try to make things as simple as possible, but not simpler than possible. And in that regard, I don't want to teach people things that they might find really confusing because they are contradictory. That, and I wrote about this in Coming to Our Senses about loving kindness practice, that makes it actually very challenging to teach mindfulness and to teach loving kindness and compassion practices like the four immeasurables, they're sometimes called, or the Brahma Viharas in Buddhism. Because unless you're a very, very skillful teacher, it seems like when you're trying to cultivate loving kindness, you're trying to make something happen that's not happening. Whereas what everything in mindfulness is about actually allowing things to be as they are. So it looks like now we're going to go into like making ourselves feel more kind or more loving. That would really be problematic from the point of view of the wisdom non-doing dimension of mindfulness. So they're not actually different, but how one threads those needles is a real art form. And so it's not something that you can just kind of naively approach without, in some sense, creating a lot of confusion in people. And believe me, there's a lot of confusion in people out there around meditation practice. And it's not necessarily always bad or harmful, but there are times that that it just becomes one more thing that you do, and certain elements of it have to do with really an attachment to getting an outcome that feels pleasant, and that's not really liberative or transformative or for that matter what I would call meditative at all. So again, it's something that everybody has to decide for themselves, but when you're in a teaching environment or a hospital environment, or if you have a community of people with chronic pain, and you think that there may be some tremendous benefit from one aspect of things, but it's not emphasized more than other aspects of things, well, it just brings up questions about how one might move forward from here that might be even more beneficial than what we've managed to do up to this point. Every single one of us is always in that situation. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. That's lovely.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Are you okay with this? Or are we okay for now with this?
My name is Christina, and I've been meditating with monks since I was 17, but really only every day for the last 3 years. And I wanted to, I'm not sure how to frame this question, so, but it comes from my experience yesterday and something that happens when I use body scan in particular. And I have your CD and I use it. I have to kind of confess, because I know you say you're not supposed to go to sleep, but I use it in the night sometimes when I need to sleep.
That's fine. I mean, I've made deals with people ever since 1979. You want to use it to fall asleep because it puts people to sleep like nobody's business.
Yes.
A lot of people come with sleep disturbance because it's one of the first things that happen when you get stressed. And I make deals with people and say, listen, secretly, it's okay to use it to fall asleep, as long as at some other time of the day you use it to fall awake. So that's my
question. I do.
But so you don't have to feel bad either.
Okay, thank you for your blessing, that helps. When I use it in the day, and sometimes when I'm meditating in a still position, I'm not asleep, I'm not awake, I'm not there, I go somewhere, and it happened yesterday. And
in the body scan?
In the body scan in particular, but also now more when I'm sitting. And I go somewhere, but it's not the me who goes somewhere. And I don't know what happens. So my question has two bits for me. One is, can you talk about that? And since when I was in my 30s, I started working with the dying. And I became very interested in it. I read it, a lot about it. I think a lot about it. And I think that the final question in the Mahabharata, the riddle that Yudhishthira has to answer, is what is the greatest miracle of all? And the answer is, each day man dies, yet he lives as though he were immortal. That stays with me. But I turned 62 weeks ago, and I'm thinking more and more about, I'd like not to be afraid of dying. Now, when the connection is, when I go to that, when I something, it's, I'm not afraid at all. And I think there might be a clue in that to not being afraid of dying. So I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
A small
question.
Let's start with the first one. Have you ever tried bringing awareness to the whatever that is that you drift off to?
I can only do that afterwards. Mm-hmm.
So is it like daydreaming? No.
No. It's an absence of ego. It's a very quiet place where I am not, and yet I fully am.
But then I'm surprised that there's no awareness there, because if you fully are, then that there'd be no you. but there would be awareness.
Well, maybe that's...
So you can investigate this. That's my point, is that the next time that happens... See if you can pick up on the... Is it happen instantaneously, or is it a kind of gradual?
No, it happens instantly. And I know the
happens instantly?
Yeah, the Buddhists talk about the monkey mind. Mine is like a mad kangaroo. And the kangaroo just... It's like
leaps.
A cartoon. Well, it leaps, but it leaps and then disappears.
Gone. Yeah, I'm not sure what to say about that. There are all sorts of mind states out there, you know, a whole, like, you know, galaxy of mind states at one point or another. And, you know, there must be some awareness there, because when you come back, you know that there's been no sense of fear. That there's no sense of you. So how do you know that? How do you know to report that now if there wasn't some, you know, taking in of that experience in some way? So that's interesting. You can investigate that, you know, in the laboratory. Now, in terms of, like, you're connecting that to dying, What did you really want to know? What was your second question?
Well, I think something you just said spoke to me. I think when it feels like that, because it's very sane, it's a very sane
mm-hmm.
feeling.
Mm-hmm.
It's like being in the center of the mountain. I am the mountain, and I'm in the center of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And my question was really, does that deep, deep peace, only I can answer this, really, relate to it's okay to die?
Well, you realize that only you can answer that, because I can't get inside your experience and assess it enough to have any kind of say anything sensible about it, but I would venture to offer that maybe you investigate what you even mean by dying, you know, and who's dying, and dying to what? Do you know the story of Ramana Maharshi? Well, in this regard, you might want to sort of investigate it a little bit. He was as a teenager in southern India, was, you know, just an ordinary teenager, was going to school, and at a certain point, like as I have understood the story, he decided that he would investigate what it would be like to die. So he got inside a coffin, and he just started asking himself, like, okay, I'm dead now. And all of a sudden, as I understand the story, his conventional narrative self just disappeared. Not for a moment, but for the rest of his very long life. And then he taught in a community in southern India, the name of which I can't pronounce. And there are still people there carrying on his tradition. But he only taught one thing. He taught the process of inquiry, and it was basically, who am I? And then, don't try to answer. Who am I? And so you can ask, well, who's asking? Who's meditating? Who's living? Very, very valuable to ask those questions and not look for answers. Just remind. I said yesterday, I think, or the day before, that I don't think our big problem is dying. I think our big problem is living. You could say, you know, and of course many people are into incarnation, reincarnation, and so forth. Every moment is dying and being reborn. Every moment is a reincarnation. I don't mean it metaphorically. We die with each out-breath, and we revitalize with each in-breath. If the out-breath isn't followed by an in-breath, dead. We take so much for granted that the next in-breath is going to come. But if we start to inquire in this deep way, in a friendly way, not in a kind of, yeah, let's rip out, rip, get to the bottom of this kind of thing, but in a friendly way, who's thinking? Who's aging? Who's frightened? Who's in pain? Who's terrified? Who's depressed? It's a very valuable way to sort of develop insight into how easily we attach to the narrative that comes along with the personal pronouns. And so the reason they call that posture that we were adopting yesterday the corpse pose is because it's an opportunity to die to who you think you are and therefore wake up to what you actually are. Ramana Maharshi then went on to teach for about 80 years, really worth, and it was all in dialogue. He never gave a talk. It was all questions. I mean, really valuable to go and listen. I mean, they're all recorded, and I don't mean listen, I mean they're all in books. And he didn't. He had no axe to grind. He had no agenda. He was just there. And it happened to him when he was like a kid. I don't think that happens very often, and so I don't think we need to be worried about it, because, like, you know, probably most of us wouldn't want to lose our conventional self that quickly. Whoops. You go home at the end of the day if you could find your home at the end of the day. Hi, honey, I'm home, only I'm not me anymore. That would be shocking. So good. So we mistake what the personal pronouns are all about, and then live a fiction, and then, you know, we die in that fiction. Our famous, wonderful philosopher, anti-slavery abolitionist, Henry David Thoreau, have you heard of him? Wrote a wonderful diary, really, of his time at Walden Pond. He went to Walden and lived there. We swim in Walden Pond all the time. My wife swims, you know, in Walden when there's ice over. And he said about that whole adventure, I went to the woods because I wish to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life and see if I could not learn what they had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. So the entire book is about mindfulness. He didn't use that word, but that's what it's about. It's a rhapsody of awareness, of present moment in touchness with nature, the interior world, the outer world, the natural economy of things, the natural botany of things. So, again, whenever kind of things that you would call meditative states or weird things happen or whatever it is, very, very important not to make a big story about them, either a happy, wonderful story, this is enlightenment, or, oh my God, I'm gonna, this is the end, or whatever, but to simply investigate. And the beauty of the English language is that we have really, really, really robust present participles. I don't know when the last time you thanked the English language for having present participles, but maybe it would be time to do it, maybe even now. In the same way as I was playing around with, like, thanking, you know, our liver for everything it does for us, like, even though we don't, you know, sort of think that much about our livers or our feet or our ears or anything, unless things start to go, as we said. To really appreciate what it is that we have, while we have it. Okay. What I would like to do at this point, so thank you for that. What I would like to do at this point is teach you or go over the, because we've been sitting for a long time, I don't know if you've noticed. But maybe it's time to do a little moving, and one of the things that we'll be doing this afternoon is I want to sort of teach you walking meditation. And we'll do some, actually, before lunch. Would that be all right? So, you can shift your posture however you like, and I will demonstrate it up here, and then we'll go out. So I'll do it limping. but basically, there are many, many different ways to engage in walking meditation. And as I said yesterday, and it's one of the four fundamental practices in, of meditative awareness, is you can't be still all the time. And there's no virtue to being still all the time. So sometimes you moving, and we did some moving, you know, free-flowing moving, and some mindful yoga. So basically, when we, in MBSR at least, when we walk quite slowly, in some traditions they walk quite rapidly, and you could bring mindfulness to running or to, you know, moving at any pace. But for this kind of walking, we actually slow it down a lot. And then, so the first thing is to bring awareness to standing. And feeling the whole body in just the ways that we've been talking about, sitting, lying down, feeling the body as a whole, standing and breathing. And if we're talking about walking, well, in order to do it, it's another thing that we take for granted that's really quite miraculous, that we can actually move, perambulate on these tiny little pads at the end of our legs. And they're architecturally designed to be able to make this happen for 70, 80, 90 years, and it's quite remarkable. And actually to take an enormous amount of pounding at times. So at a certain point, if you're standing someplace, and I'm going to suggest you actually walk in a lane, either inside or outside, fine. But that you walk in the lane Which means, and it doesn't have to be very far. I'm guessing this is something like 8 feet long. You're not, it doesn't have to be any further than that, because you're not going anywhere. Is it just walking? And the challenge is, can I be with every step? So at a certain point, you notice that you're not going to get this thing walking without an intention. Something has to mobilize the body, or it will just stand here forever. And it's kind of mysterious what does it. But at a certain point, you'll notice that some executive function fires off and sort of the messages get going, you know. And then you can notice that once that happens, that the weight shifts onto 1 foot, okay, in the anticipation of a leg lifting. So there's a kind of shifting of the weight, and then the lifting of the foot, and then it goes out in front of you and it makes contact with the floor. So lifting, moving, placing, and just, and then a shifting of the weight onto the forward foot, and notice my heel comes up, and then so it's just walking, okay, but it's slow walking, and it's awareness of walking. So it's walking with an awareness of walking. And there are lots of different things that you could be aware of. One would be the kissing of the ground with the foot, okay, and the heel coming up. I mean, the whole sequence of things that happens, and at a certain point, which I have reached, you come to the end of your lane. And then you can just stand there. And you're drinking in through the eyes what's before you. It's not a sightseeing tour of the King's Center. Or of everybody else who's out there walking, looking like that. We're all like, you know, in the movie The Night of the Living Dead. And at a certain point then, you'll turn. So you can notice the intention to turn, because it doesn't happen without an intention. And then you turn, and now you're gazing in an entirely different direction, drinking in, and you're drinking in whatever while you're turning. And then, you don't have to look at your feet, because the feet know how to do this actually quite well. I might have to look at my feet because I don't know where the precipice is. And then you're just turning it. So you're not going anywhere. You're just where you are. But the mind will have none of this. So it will decide, first of all, where is my lane? Then God forbid if somebody crosses your lane. So the mind is going to, as usual, have a life of its own. And it's very doubtful that I will get over there without having been distracted by something or other. This is really challenging. You know, so it's very easy to walk on autopilot. And not, no, it's just like it's easy to drive on autopilot and, whoops, and not know where you're going, drive to the wrong place, or, you know, not know what you passed along the way. So this is actually an invitation. It's just sitting, walking. Okay? If you want to be a walking mountain, if that helps, be a walking mountain. A walking mountain is a very famous image in Chinese Zen. And Gary Snyder wrote about it a lot in a book called Mountains and Rivers. So, that's it. Any questions? It's just the same as you would practice sitting when you're walking, except that your eyes are open, Although you can experiment with your eyes being, say, half open or even closed, but be careful if you don't get into. There are a few things I suggest you not get into, even though the mind likes to get really creative. Don't get into kind of turning this into Tai Chi, for instance. You know? Even if you love Tai Chi, don't get into that. Don't get into whatever, you know. It's like, or these are all wonderful things to do, but not now. Okay? Just walking, just regular walking. Let's see. So it's 25 to the hour. We're going to have lunch at 1. So let me just. Let me just ask you. We didn't really talk about it yet, but would you like to have this lunch be silent, or would you like to talk among yourselves? How many of you would like to have it be silent? Raise your hands. How many of you would like to have some conversation? Minority. Okay. I tell you what. Well, we don't have that much. Let's see. Lunch is an hour. So how about, let's do it this way. Let's actually have it be silent until 20 to 2. No, I'm not joking. We'll have it be silent from, and really silent, not because we're imposing it, but because it's potentially valuable. And we'll really be present with our eating, with standing on line, with how long it takes to get the food, with all of that stuff. And at 20 to 2, we go into mindful conversation with whoever we're with, or, you know, or finding people to be with, or whatever. And that way, we'll have both. Okay? And then we'll come back here at 2 o'clock. So I won't even ring bells when 1 o'clock happens to signal the lunch, because your belly will ring a bell, and your eyes will ring the bell, so you'll know that it's lunchtime. And then, but we will keep silent between now and 20 to 2. Is that okay for everybody? So just let dropping back into, you know, and getting comfortable with moving from silence to speech, from speech to silence. It's not like we're privileging one over the other, but it's like one seamless continuity of awareness through it all. All right? Good. And during this time, please don't ask me to sign books or anything like that, even silently. Let's just practice. Let's just be in our own skin and in our own bones and in our own experience. And then we'll come back at 2 o'clock. And at 2 o'clock, I would ask you to go right back into silence, take your seats, and we'll begin the afternoon. Okay? Thank you, folks.